Good evening.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Every month, we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee, anything from a 20th all the way up to a 100th anniversary. This is your devoted host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. If you've just discovered our show, welcome. If you're a regular listener, we are delighted to have you back. Alfred Hitchcock is credited with multiple masterpieces across his filmography, from The Lady Vanishes and Notorious to Vertigo, Psycho, and North by Northwest, and so many others. But there was one movie in particular he named as his very favorite, Shadow of a Doubt, which premiered on January 12, 1943. This finely crafted study in suspense and twisted family dynamics is also highly regarded by this month's guest, who names Shadow of a Doubt her favorite Hitchcock film. This episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by Carrie Rickey, former film critic for several publications, including The Village Voice, The Boston Herald, and The Philadelphia Inquirer. Carrie and I will discuss why Shadow of a Doubt is worth celebrating 80 years later, its influence on later movies and filmmakers, notable directorial choices that make this picture a cut above, messages that can be mined from the movie, and much more. So if you're a Hitchcock fan, you are in for a real treat as we put this treasured work under the magnifying glass and make a case for why it still matters in 2023 and beyond. Now, to fully appreciate Shadow of Doubt and how it came to be, we're going to knowledge up a bit first and give the old Wikipedia wheel a spin. So here's a bit of background on the film. Shadow of a Doubt is a 1943 American psychological thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Teresa Wright and Joseph Cotten. Written by Thornton Wilder, Sally Benson, and Alma Reville, the director's wife, the film was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Story. The plot involves teenager Charlotte Newton, aka Charlie, who lives with her parents in Santa Rosa, California. Her charming and sophisticated Uncle Charlie comes to visit on short notice, and young Charlie slowly realizes her uncle is harboring dark secrets. The project began when the head of David Selznick's story department, Margaret McDonnell, told Hitchcock that her husband, Gordon McDonnell, had an interesting idea for a novel she thought would make for a good movie. His idea, called Uncle Charlie, was based on the true story of Earl Nelson, a serial killer of the late 1920s known as the Gorilla Man. Shadow of a Doubt was both filmed and set in Santa Rosa, which was portrayed as a paragon of a supposedly peaceful, small, pre-war American city. Since Thornton Wilder wrote the original script, the story is set in a small American town, a popular setting of Wilder's, but with an added Hitchcock touch to it. The film was scored by Dmitri Tiomkin, his first collaboration with Hitchcock, the others being Strangers on a Train, I Confess, and Dial M for Murder. In his score, Tiomkin quotes The Merry Widow Waltz by composer Franz Lehár as a leitmotif for Uncle Charlie and his serial murders. By the way, if you're curious, Hitchcock makes his cameo in this film about 16 minutes in. It's on the train to Santa Rosa. He's playing bridge. Now, he's the one with the full suit of spades, which represents the game's best possible hand. Fitting, right? In 1991, Shadow of a Doubt was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for being deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. What does Rotten Tomatoes have to say? Well, the site awards a perfect 100% fresh score for Shadow of a Doubt, where its average critical rating comes in at a very snazzy 9.2 out of 10, and its audience score is an impressive 89%. Let's give a listen now, shall we, to the original theatrical trailer for this month's anniversary film.
Thank you.
of foul sty. Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine?
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself. Your hands! Let me go, Uncle Charlie! Let me go!
Yep, I would be failing in my duties as host of Cineversary if I didn't give you fair warning that me and my guest, we will be traversing crucial plot points and crossing into twisty revelation territory as we travel through our conversation of Shadow of a Doubt. So if you've arrived at this episode blind, see the light, brothers and sisters, by pausing this show and watching said film post-haste. Here, listen to some good advice from young Charlie.
Take your chance. Go.
All right, now that there's no more room for doubt on spoilers, it's all systems go. I'm delighted to introduce Kiri Rickey, former film critic for many esteemed publications, including The Village Voice, The Boston Herald, and for 25 years, The Philadelphia Inquirer. Kiri, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to our Cineversary podcast.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you for asking me.
Of course. When I saw that, well, first off, I want more female voices represented on our show, and it's been too long, so I certainly had that in my priority box, but I also had you on my radar for quite a while. I've loved your work over the years. And then I saw that you listed this as your favorite Hitchcock. I thought, wow, this is a perfect marriage. I hope she says yes, and you did. So we are here, and it's fantastic. So do you recall, Kiri, when and where you first watched Shadow of a Doubt and maybe your first impressions of the movie?
Since I always remember where I saw every movie in a theater, I have to guess that I know I saw it when I was pretty young, maybe 8 or 9 years old. So I'm guessing, well, it has to be on TV, and I grew up in Los Angeles. So it was probably on Channel 9 or Channel 11 that had a lot of movies. And my reaction was that it hypnotized me. I mean, I didn't move.
Wow. Okay.
And it scared the bejesus out of me. And the only other movie that did that to me as a child was Night of the Hunter.
Okay.
Which is also about a guy who kills widows.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You've got a common thread there. So you were kind of terrified and mesmerized. And that's a pretty young age to be introduced to early Hitchcock. Yeah, so it stuck with you. Have you revisited this film many times over the years, I would assume?
Oh, I've taught it. I've watched it. I've argued it. Mm-hmm. But I think those two movies, Night of the Hunter and Shadow of a Doubt, really struck me because they were about such vulnerable innocents who go through this ordeal and become the heroes.
Yeah, I can imagine Night of the Hunter would be particularly impactful to a young child because, of course, they are the innocents on the run in that film. Here, of course, you have young Charlie, who's a teenage girl, and that could certainly get in your head, too, in terms of what she has to go through.
Yeah, well, also, there are three kids in the movie, and they're all, the other two are so verbal and too smart for their own good.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about this. The precociousness of especially that younger sister when we have time.
And yes, Hitchcock named all the characters after members of his family.
I read that. Yes. So, yeah, let's dig in a little deeper here. Why is Shadow of a Doubt listed as your favorite Hitchcock film? And also, I'm just curious if this is one of your all-time favorites in general, not just among Hitchcock works.
If you asked me to list my top 100 American movies, it would be on my list.
Okay.
And, you know, there'd certainly be, I mean, I think this was one of Hitchcock's great movie-making periods. You've got Notorious. It's a great period. He's early in America. He makes his first U.S. movie in 1941. And this is maybe his third or fourth. And it's really
I think it's actually his fifth or sixth, if I'm not mistaken.
God, because did he make that many movies in America?
But many say it's his first real American movie, even though there was...
Oh, even he said that.
Right. But there had been Saboteur, which is set in America, but it has an international feel in many ways. And there had been, of course, Foreign Correspondent, which takes place, you know, overseas. And of course, we're talking Rebecca. Yeah, he had established a foothold here, but this is really the first major work in America. America that seemed to capture a lot of attention.
Yes, and it has two of the authors, Thornton Wilder and Sally Benson, are really great at Americana and finding the essence of American experience. And Wilder did, I think, the original, the outline and all the dramatic components. And Sally Benson, the New Yorker writer who we know best as the author of the sketches that became Meet Me in St. Louis. All the comedy is hers. And it's one of the reasons it's a particularly good and enjoyable Hitchcock movie is it is so funny and it is so scary.
Yes.
And it's very American.
Absolutely. We're going to have fun talking about all of these elements, but especially the Americana that is infused in Shadow of a Doubt and the comedy, as you mentioned. So it's a very distinct work in his oeuvre. But so it still remains your favorite Hitchcock?
Yes. It's in such a great period. I love Notorious.
So do I.
I love North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
I very much like Rear Window. Those are in my top five Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's hard to pick, but great ones to nominate and ruminate over. But yeah, this is a very high, one that places high for me as well. But I want to ask you next how the movie has stood the test of time. Now, you started to get into this, I think, with a great answer just in terms of the pedigree, the writers involved, for example, Thornton Wilder. I'd like to expound upon that a little bit. But yeah, why is Shadow of a Doubt worth honoring 80 years after its release, Carrie? And why and how does the film still matter, do you think?
Well, I think the contrast between the big city and the small town, between the innocent idealist and the cynical misanthrope, these are polar opposites that still mean a lot. Those are timeless.
Right.
You can go back to Canterbury Tales for big city, small place. You can go back to the Bible for the innocent and the cynical. But these are just important emotional components.
Absolutely.
That don't age. And there are things that are dated in the movie, but it certainly passes the posterity test for me.
Oh, agreed. We will talk about what has maybe not aged so well a little bit later, if we have time permitting.
Okay.
Yeah, anything else in terms of why Shadow of a Doubt still matters or how it stood the test of time?
It's beautifully acted. It's a little bit like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, because you have two people, the older Charlie, played by Joseph Cotten, and the younger Charlotte, also Charlie, the young Charlie, played by Teresa Wright. They see the subtext of everything, and they're having their own coded language to talk about it. Yeah, they're seeing a different drama than all the other characters are seeing. That's really interesting for a viewer, seeing how a guy could be so horrible and yet he could be celebrated by a city, be given the keys to the city and be fired by everyone from the pastor of the largest church to the mayor to whomever.
And then be memorialized later and mourned by the entire village. But yeah, it absolutely every point you bring up is so valid. And especially the last one, I like what you said there just in terms of how they're on almost a different dramatic plane in terms of what they're battling against each other.
Both as actors and as characters. It's very powerful. And also, Hitchcock had women characters who were very smart. The Eva Marie Saint character in North by Northwest, the Ingrid Bergman character, and I can't remember the name of where she's a psychiatrist.
Spellbound.
Yes. But here you have a very young woman, and remembering that so many of the females in Hitchcock movies were decorative, you have a young girl who is so finely attuned to emotion and motive that she becomes a superheroine, and she's just really smart. I think that's what captivated me as a child, that I never seen a young woman like that.
Yeah, I really love the character of young Charlie. As you said, contrasted so well with her uncle. The whole dynamics of that relationship is fascinating to me to this day.
And creepy.
Yeah, no question about it. So in answer to this question for me, how it still matters, why it's still worth, celebrating 80 years later. Hitchcock himself, he called Shadow of a Doubt his favorite movie among all the pictures he directed. I guess he had said this multiple times. And it's easy to see why, because here is a film that's endowed with richly layered characters, right? A brooding atmosphere of infiltrating evil, contrasting against a bright bright and cheery family milieu. You've got all these memorable performances, as you said, by Joseph Cotten, Teresa Wright, perhaps the best of their careers. You know, you got Cotten playing against type as Uncle Charlie, and this is kind of a rare villain role in his acting career. You think about the masterfully composed shots imbued with, you know, stylized lighting that evoke the very best of the classic Hollywood period and the encroaching influence of film noir as well. So you've got a lot of elements coalescing.
I believe it's the only Hitchcock noir, unless you count I Confess.
Yeah, it certainly imbues some elements of noir, absolutely. This is also a memorable milestone in his filmography because, as you were mentioning, he infuses pessimism and cynicism and mistrust into his depiction of, you know, this wholesome, clean-cut, old-fashioned, sleepy little burg of Santa Rosa, which actually exists. This isn't some fictional town. This is a real town.
And it's actually where George Lucas is from.
It's so interesting, right? There's 6 degrees of separation there. But the pessimism and the cynicism, Carrie, that those feelings about small-town USA are remarkable to me when you ponder that this is a film shot and released in the middle of World War II, a time when America and Hollywood tried to emphasize positive morale-boosting messages, right?
Correct. It comes out, I think it was mostly shot in 1942. It's coming out at the beginning of the war.
Right.
Relatively. But don't you see a couple people in uniform in it?
Yes. Going into one establishment, she's coming out of it. So there's little hints that, yeah, the war is going on, but it's not a central part of the story, of course.
Right.
What else makes it work so well for me is that we're talking about Hitchcock, right? So what does he do? He builds mood and atmosphere and disquiet in a seemingly benign and charming and comfortable locale. In this case, Everytown, USA, as embodied in Santa Rosa. And to me, the suspense here is a slow builder, as is often the case with Hitchcock. But it insidiously creeps into a place the characters feel safe, and it invades this middle-class home that just invites us in and is so welcoming, this domicile. It usurps the safety and values of a time in America that was known for, like, Norman Rockwell paintings, right? This is apple pie Americana, but I guess you could call the crust burnt because there's kind of a critique of assumed American innocence going on here, which is at the heart of the subversive nature of Uncle Charlie entering it. You mentioned so wisely just Thornton Wilder. I think it still matters that the screenplay was co-written by this Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. He wasn't the only one, as you said. Here's a talent purposely chosen by Hitch to weave a wistful but twisted vision of this small town that's threatened by a secret dark force. Wilder was an ideal handpicked choice by Hitchcock because he was the author of Our Town. This was a popular play that depicts everyday life in a small American town and that uses minimal props and scenery. And if you really look closely at Shadow of a Doubt, it seems cut from the same cloth, right? It just seems like a perfect marriage of writers to the subject matter. And tell me what you think about this, but several critics regard Shadow of a Doubt as possibly the purest distillation of Hitchcock's style and common themes and the director's first American masterpiece. His first U.S. feature, which was Rebecca, what did it do? Well, it won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Like, right out of the gate, he is, you know, on the map in terms of, wow, this is a director to be taken very seriously. But much of that glory for Rebecca is shared with Selznick, and many feel that this here, Shadow of a Doubt, is a more personal work that surpasses Rebecca and stands as his finest American feature up to this point, at least, in his filmography. So I think it was an important milestone for Hitch.
Oh, I do too. And I think that Hitchcock was very glad to get away from Selznick, who he felt was suffocating.
Yeah, he was lent out to the studio here to make the picture. I think it was Universal Pictures, wasn't it?
It is Universal,
yeah,
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So thankfully for us, yeah, he wasn't under the yoke of Selznick 100%. And finally, he got out of the contract by the middle of the decade of the 40s. And he really started to soar because he was making more pictures that he wanted to do. But any event, I wanted to trace the influence this movie had on the cinema or filmmakers who may have been inspired by it. So, for example, in the wake of Shadow of a Doubt, you have films like Orson Welles' The Stranger, which is kind of similar in terms of plot and themes.
It is.
And then many decades later, you have a more direct descendant in something like Blue Velvet by David Lynch, right? I mean, these are movies that explore danger lurking in a seemingly safe suburban community.
Yeah.
They are two inheritors of the plot and design of Shadow of a Doubt. So those instantly spring to mind. But then later, you have some other descendants as well. You could look to, for example, a horror film called The Stepfather. I don't know if you've ever seen this. It's from 1987.
Oh, yeah, I already did
that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually not bad. It's kind of a sleeper.
Park Chan-wook's Stoker, which actually opens with obvious homage to Shadow of a Doubt.
Is that right? I've not seen this film, Stoker. Okay, I have to put that on the list. But yeah, there is Bad Influence from 1990. There is The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen Brothers film, 2001.
Oh, but I hadn't thought of The Man Who Wasn't There. Yes.
Yeah, and then I thought, this is a very loose association, granted, but The Usual Suspects, if you recall, the end of that film, you have Kaiser Soze, who walks away with this fake limp. And I thought of that film on this most recent rewatch because Charlie emerging from the train with this hobble and you know, using a cane, but then he quickly abandons them. So it's all a charade, of course.
The people who have seen him on the train leave. He's no longer there.
Right. So it's very interesting to see the lasting influence of a film like Shadow of a Doubt all these years later and throughout the decades. So any others you can cite?
No, you did a really good job. I hadn't thought of the small town aspect. And I think, there's so many movies about the city slicker and the small town. And
mm-hmm. Right. Well, as far as antecedents, films that came before that might have influenced Shadow of a Doubt a little bit, it's interesting that he admired the low-budget horror films of RKO producer Val Lewton. You know, he has Cat People in 1942, The Leopard Man and The Seventh Victim. Those are both 1943. And these films depict, you know, malignancy and menace lurking about in everyday settings in small towns. So maybe some of that rubbed off on Hitchcock a little bit.
I don't think Cat People is a small town.
Well, yeah, that's true. But in terms of everyday settings, people who hold normal jobs, it's like normal Americans, if you will, right? Leopard Man is more the small town kind of angle, but the everyday settings in contemporary America in the early 40s, I think that there's a little bit of smoke there. Let's talk a little bit about how Hitchcock had said that Shadow of a Doubt was his personal favorite among the films he directed, Carrie. So why do you believe he held it in such high regard?
Well, he gave quotes to the effect that it was the first time he felt in the United States that he had the support of writers and crew who really had knowledge of America.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a tourist in America anymore. He felt that he was on terra firma here. And I think it enabled him to really think about the family, his own, and project a lot of his, as they say in Latin, mishigas, on the, his own, family torments and anxieties onto what family meant. And there's a little bit of hysteria in the character of Patricia Collins, who plays the mother. And she apparently was taken from a larger town in Minnesota. What is it?
I think they referenced that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where everything was more romantic and Charlie is her beloved younger brother. And she's like been taken out and in this smaller town where there's no romance. And young Charlie says at the beginning of the movie, there's a big problem with the family. The family's in trouble. We need something to change us.
Yeah, get out of these humdrums.
Yeah, and we need romance.
Mm-hmm. Be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah, and Uncle Charlie is a very romantic figure, well-dressed, catnip to women, very handsome, and bearing gifts.
Oh, yeah, he's a charmer, no question about that. And quite outspoken, too.
He has that strange monologue about women. About widows who...
Oh, the misogyny shines through from early on.
Yes. And I would like to think it's because a misogynist was outwitted that I loved this movie, but I don't think I was that sophisticated at age 8.
Well, there's that. You can't discount that, of course. There's the vindication by the end of, in terms of that angle. But yeah, you're absolutely right. So all of these elements are part of what must have intrigued Hitchcock in terms of wanting to do this picture. A famous Hitchcock biographer, Donald Spoto, had called this film, quote, the first spiritually autobiographical film of Hitchcock's career. And to provide context, the director's mother grew gravely ill back in England while the screenplay was written.
And he couldn't get back there because
all
ships were blocked. Yeah.
Yeah, it's World War II. You know, he's challenged in terms of being able to get back to his sick mother. And so during production, sadly, you know, his mother passed away, and Hitchcock poured a lot of his heart and soul into this movie, especially its more idealized vision of domestic bliss found in Santa Rosa, California. It's also interesting that you had mentioned that many characters are named after Hitchcock's, you know, family and so forth. His own mom, her name was Emma, and that's the mother character here. And interestingly, Emma represents the last time a major maternal character is shown in a positive light in a Hitchcock film, because subsequent mothers would be evil or undesirable to some extent, or silly or what have you. And so this might have been the last hurrah in terms of a positive representation of a maternal figure.
Doris Day in The Man Who Knew Too Much?
Well, in terms of a mother of a major character.
You're
right, but when you see like an older mother of you know, the protagonist in a movie, you think of Strangers on a Train and Cary Grant's mother in North by Northwest. And there's, of course, Psycho is the major linchpin there.
Yes.
But you're right. I may have overspoken, because there are some mother characters who don't fit that grain.
Right. And Patricia Collins is such a great actress.
She's fantastic. And you see those tears on her face, and they don't seem fake to me. It seems like she's really welling from a pool of emotions that are genuine and authentic.
And when young Charlie gets the carbon monoxide from being locked in the garage, Patricia Collins just falls apart. No, I have to stay here. I can't bear to leave you here alone. You know.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And, you know, to me, we could talk about this in a moment, but in terms of some of the silly aspects of the plot, like, you know, the whole silliness to me of why can't she just tell the authorities or her parents, for Christ's sakes, already? I mean, her uncle's trying to kill her. It's time to do something and to get help. But I do understand that she wants to spare her mother. Her uncle is absolutely right. It would devastate her mother to learn the truth about this. So I get that. I put myself in young Charlie's shoes and I think, oh goodness, wow, I just don't want my mother to be destroyed like this. And then it is no small point, I think, that most of the picture is shot on location in Santa Rosa. Not 100%, but a lot of it.
Well, that's why the preposterous parts of the plot work, because it is so rooted in white picket fence small townness.
This is true. Yes.
Hitchcock, who worked with sets a lot, even in North by Northwest, when they're climbing Mount Rushmore, it's not the real Mount Rushmore.
It's all fabricated, right?
But it just seems really real. And so Teresa Wright's hysteria, or Patricia Collins's hysteria, seems so real. What doesn't seem real are the younger siblings, who are such wise asses. Yeah, the kids are smarter than the parents. I mean, that's...
Yeah, a little too precocious for my taste. The younger boy, not so problematic, but the younger daughter is getting on my nerves a little bit. And he likes to do funny things, make the, you know, children in his story sometimes ultra intelligent, but it's not very plausible. However, they are characters you won't forget. Let's put it that way, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but shooting on location, he commented on how he enjoyed the amiable nature of the town and its people, and it made the shoot a pleasant one. Hitchcock was known for not really relishing the actual filming. Most of the movie was done in his head on paper, and this became more of a laborious chore to actually shoot the movie, usually, for him. But it sounds like this was a pleasant one. But unlike some of Hitchcock's other works of suspense, I think that this one has more fully realized characters, especially the two Charlies, who formed this symbiotic relationship. And Hitchcock was quoted as saying he was particularly fond of this movie because, quote, it was one of those rare occasions where you could combine character with suspense. Usually in a suspense story, there isn't time to develop character. So I would totally agree. I think that character development here is strong, and that's part of what makes the movie such an enriching experience. We did mention the plot. It's not necessarily airtight or completely credible. There are some things that are a bit laughable to me today. I don't want to waste too much time on it, but I think the important thing is that Hitchcock isn't going for plausibility here. I think it's more the mood and the tone and the ambiance and that dynamic between the two Charlies. And there are going to be, to me anyway, some silly elements of the plot that don't hold up the greatest 80 years later.
What doesn't age well for me is the, you know, the Merry Widow murder plot, because the Merry Widow operetta was known to everyone in 1940. It was just very well known. It had been made into a movie in like 1934. So a lot of moviegoers knew it, and it worked then. It worked as visual and musical shorthand then. Today, the credit sequence with all these 19th century figures waltzing, and it crops up several times, it looks really hokey to me.
Yeah, it seems a bit of a non sequitur to me, just in terms of, okay, it's a visual motif that reappears and is synced with the music, but okay, it's happening in both Charlie's heads, I guess, simultaneously.
Yeah, the joke was that these were merry widows. They were widows with a lot of money. And so it's kind of a funny joke in 1943.
Okay, I appreciate the context, because I didn't know it was that popular or well-known. But another bigger problem for me that stopped me dead in my tracks, we see Uncle Charlie pass over a stack of $41,000 bills to the banker. Now, that's a denomination that has long been out of circulation, granted, but adjusted for inflation, that would be like carrying $689,000 in your pocket, which just doesn't seem plausible.
Right? I mean, we're talking about a time when I think the average income of an American family was like $5,000.
And this doesn't raise any eyebrows? Like, I see that his comments raise eyebrows because he's very insensitive. But wow, where is he getting this money?
From the dead Danes he's getting.
Well, we know that. But in terms of in the banker's heads, like, you're just carrying around in your back pocket. More problematic to me even than that are the silly plot movers, like young Charlie being afraid to tell her parents or the authorities, her uncle's trying to kill her, and the detectives agreeing not to arrest him in town to spare a scandal. I get it. It's 1943, different times. But yeah, there are some elements that maybe haven't aged as well.
Hitchcock movies are not documentaries.
No, absolutely. So yeah, let's talk more about the director here. What choices does Hitchcock make in Shadow of Doubt that most impress you?
For me, it was the themes he carries through the whole movie. First of all, the ESP between the Charlies, lying on beds and the intercutting, almost seeming to face each other. They're kind of in psychologically in bed together.
Yeah.
In the opening scenes, which is very disquieting and very creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Then their telegrams to each other almost cross on the wires.
Yep.
And then that really creepy mock wedding. I mean, he slides the ring stolen from one of the merry widows onto her hand as though they're getting married.
Yeah, it almost feels like either a proposal or they're at the altar, right? It just doesn't feel right.
It's not right. Mm-hmm. And, all the incestuous implications that has. And I think the real big theme in many Hitchcock movies, and this is not my original thought, this is comes from reading Claude Chabrol and other French critics for Cahiers du Cinéma, they being Catholic recognized that Hitchcock had the sense of the transfer of guilt.
Oh yeah.
That Catholics believe in original sin. Mm-hmm. And to purge his characters of the original sin, Hitchcock kind of made them assume the sins of others. And in this case, Charlie has to kill the killer to cleanse herself, to purify herself.
Hmm.
Although
it is important to note that he kind of dies accidentally and she is defending herself, but I don't necessarily think she's pushing him off the train. But yes, she has an inclination. She even says,
I'm going to kill if you don't get out of town.
If you
I'm
don't
kill
get out,
you.
Right. Yes. So, her intentions are very strong and she's emphatic about it. So, yes, this is at the heart of the conflict. But yeah, in terms of directorial choices, I think that the artist here prioritizes subtlety and simplicity over things like grandiose visuals or sensationalistic storytelling, or, the film isn't filled with glamorous starlets or marquee stars. It doesn't have showy set pieces or gimmicky techniques. And I think that causes us to focus more, Carrie, on the central thematic conflicts and the well-developed characters. It's a very simple, streamlined story. It's relatively simplistic. You recall how Joe Newton, the dad, says to his friend Herbie when discussing a detective story, "Those writers from the other side get too fancy." I think this is a bit of an in-joke from Hitchcock about how this screenplay was kept simple and written by Americans. At least that's half true if you consider that Hitchcock and his wife also collaborated. But the plot is lean, the setting is relatively mundane, there isn't much action, and all the characters, aside from Uncle Charlie, are middle-class normies who lead uninteresting lives. But to me, Carrie, the personification of Uncle Charlie, this is the primary fuel that drives the engine here, because he emerges, to me anyway, as a fascinatingly complex individual with these quirks and curious traits and idiosyncrasies that create an unpredictable but colorful character. He's irresponsibly carrying loose cash. He's not exactly careful about covering his incriminating tracks. And despite saying that it's the little details that are most important to him, he's kind of careless in a lot of ways. He's outspoken. He's verbally insensitive, like when he makes those callous remarks about Joe and his job at the bank, which are so cringy. And yet he's careful not to reveal too much about his past, right? And though he's capable of terrible violence, he's beloved and trusted by his family. So I think all of these disparities make for a really fascinating character.
Well, he exudes the glamour of sophistication and intelligence. And he thinks he's more intelligent than everyone else.
Right.
And they're cowed by it. And I love when Patricia Collins says of her brother, "Oh, he's in business. You know, like men are in business."
Right. Yeah. This amorphous, ambiguous kind of explanation of, oh, yeah, you know, he's just another one of those. But I love what Peter Bogdanovich said in an interview, that Hitchcock, you know, never makes his villains cliche, and that he, quote, goes out of his way to give this Uncle Charlie character as much depth as possible. Totally agree. Again, it's this interrelationship between the two Charlies that is so crucial here. But Joseph Cotten, perfect casting and a great performance.
Yeah, he's very, very scary here. And from the beginning, he's all about the money. And from the beginning, I think that Teresa Wright has that great line to her mother, "Mom, you're talking about money. I'm talking about soul."
That's telling.
And it's so beautifully set up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess that's Thornton Wilder, you know, talking about the two kinds of people in the world.
Sure. But you consider, Carrie, Hitchcock's ability to insinuate disturbing violence and infuse this subversive tone and suggest the slightest hint of incestuous sexuality, what we were talking about a moment ago, without depicting anything graphically, nor could he at the time. But he could have shown, for example, like he does in Strangers on a Train, you know, strangling of the victims, but we're never shown Uncle Charlie, you know, actually dispatching.
Oh, well, we kind of are. They're sitting at the dinner table and he's stolen the newspaper clip about the Merry Widow killer. He's strangling that paper.
Oh, no, I get it. We see him do things with his hands throughout the film, but we don't actually have a, you know, flashback scene of him strangling anyone, which he could have done this in 1943. And yet, the most inappropriately creepy he gets with his niece is maybe when he gives her that ring, puts his arms around her. But yeah, even 80 years later, that is still cringy. Yet the implications and the, you know, the potentialities of these sins, they churn the waters enough to make it a tense journey for us as viewers. And on this most recent rewatch, you know, I was really struck by how often the director places Uncle Charlie in profile, often in a close-up or a medium shot. You know, so in other words, he either faces left or right at roughly 90 degrees from the lens and 90 degrees from other characters in the shot. So what's the value there? Maybe Hitchcock is suggesting that there are multiple sides to the uncle's character, including a side we can't see literally or figuratively in that moment.
I think, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's just you pay more attention to these things on rewatches and you know, you maybe value the significance of them on further viewings. But I love, as further evidence of Hitchcock's visual savvy, that he repeats the dreamlike imagery of the dancers waltzing hauntingly in his mind. I know that I said that that doesn't work very well for me. But in terms of consistency, he is consistent about that. I love how Hitchcock employs the dramatic push zoom to emphasize the ring on young Charlie's finger when she walks down the stairs. That's a great kind of showpiece. He uses canted camera angles to suggest the world made, you know, crooked by the uncle's presence.
Yes.
And it's a nice touch to have Uncle Charlie break the fourth wall by, you know, turning to look directly at the camera, at us in a key shot. So, yeah, there's a lot going on there. Well, let's briefly talk then about themes and messages or morals to the story, if you will. So what rises to the surface for you, Carrie, in terms of a theme?
Well, as I said before, it's the classic story of the innocent, mm-hmm. you know, versus the sick, or idealist versus the misanthrope. But it's, as Roger Ebert used to say, it's really not what the movie is about. It's how it's about it. And how it's about it is that I think, as I said before, there's a lot of twinning in the movie between the two characters, but there's a lot of repeats of scenes. You know, there's that scene when young Charlie is in the garage talking to McDonald Carey, the Fed, and they get locked in by Uncle Charlie. And later in the movie, young Charlie will most certainly suffocate by carbon monoxide because her uncle has locked her in the garage again as the car is going. With all the twinning and everything, the number two runs through the whole movie. Scenes happen twice. The ring happens twice.
Wow, that's really perceptive. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
They go to a bar called the Till 2.
Yeah, I think you're onto something. Now I'm going to have to watch it all over again.
But it's structured. It's composed. The themes kind of repeat. It's a contrapuntal movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the sweet candy at the heart of the sucker that Hitchcock wants us to savor.
It's composed beautifully. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't see the ridiculous, you know, the silly stuff in it. I mean, and also Henry Travers plays the young Charlie's father, and his best friend, played by Hume Cronyn in what I think is his film debut.
Yes.
Are always talking about crime novels, mm-hmm. and how to kill people. Both young Charlie and old Charlie are looking at them like, oh, amateurs, which is very funny. Yeah.
Absolutely. The comedic subplot is just delicious.
It's really funny. And while older Charlie is condescending to them, it's quite funny. And the character of Anne, the young sister who's the brainiac, who wants to live in a library, you know, she wants to, you know, marry a librarian. All that stuff is so funny. And that's what families are really funny.
Absolutely.
And this family is living on top of a volcano and it doesn't know it. And that's mm-hmm. funny. You know?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's all kinds of in-jokes.
As I said before, it's like watching Rosencrantz and Guildenstern saying, no, 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 we should not be looking at that. We should be looking at what's really happening here. We should be looking at the subtext, not the text here.
Yes.
And it's very sophisticated. And that still works. It's just, it's so beautifully structured.
No question about
and it. And I think everyone talks about Hitchcock being the master of the stairway scene. And I think the stairway scenes in this movie are just incredible.
Oh, yeah. You can't have a Hitchcock film without a staircase. And this one has it in spades.
When young Charlie has a great recognition scene, mm-hmm. she's at the bottom of the indoor stairway looking up at her uncle on the top of the landing. And Uncle Charlie, I'm on to you.
Yep.
And it's really creepy. And then there's the back stairway, which is exterior. Mm. And the accident that Charlie, young Charlie survives all these accidents on the stairs. It's really interesting, but it is that theme of two. Often the theme is three times, but in this movie, the theme is doubled.
I love it. I never would have thought about this, but now here's yet more proof that I need to go back and watch it yet again. Okay, Carrie, if you'll bear with me here, I've got a few themes to ruminate on. Number one theme for me from this movie is rot and infection beneath a pristine surface. So think about Santa Rosa, right? It's an idyllic small town. You've got friendly traffic cops on every corner, residents who know your name, kids who respect their elders, you know, the children say their prayers every night at bedtime. Yet this village, it's not as wholesome as it looks since this mysterious stranger came into town, right?
Right.
Shadow of a Doubt, to me, it's about the intrusion of evil into a typical American household via a Trojan horse of sorts. And, you know, the unsettling nature of this relationship is that the murderer, is a relative who shares the same blood and the same genes as the decent, morally upstanding family members whose home he has infiltrated. Now, this suggests that every other member of that clan, particularly young Charlie, can become infected with or victimized by Uncle Charlie's malevolence. The director here, he makes the viewer second guess the sanctity and unimpeachable ideals of small town society by doing what? Well, permitting Uncle Charlie's dark influence and negative worldview to seep into young Charlie's mind.
Yes.
The uncle, he tries to taint her perception of the town and the people she loves. He says, "You live in a dream. You're a sleepwalker, blind. How do you know what the world is like? Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine? The world's a hell." Now, in the same scene at the restaurant, young Charlie sees, who does she see? It's a cautionary figure, the morose waitress who serves them, remember?
Yeah.
And this person is a reflection of what young Charlie could become in the years ahead. So let's look at young Charlie, right? She's this kind, chaste, gentle teenager. But as the picture progresses, she finds a festering and violent animosity within herself that compels her to threaten violence. She tells her uncle, "Go away or I'll kill you myself." Theme number two that stands out is you've got a human monster in plain sight.
Yeah.
Let's look at Uncle Charlie. He's depicted as a kind of horrific psychological vampire, if you really look at it. Now, consider he prefers to lie in the dark behind curtains. He evades capture by the two detectives in the early part of the movie. He doesn't appear winded from, you know, them chasing after him. He insists on not being photographed. He seems to possess a telepathic power to communicate with his niece, right? And then later, just to hammer home this thought, you've got the detective boyfriend who mentions the story of Dracula. So maybe it's a far-fetched theory, but I think there's some there. And then theme number three for me is pretty obvious one, toxic misogyny.
Yeah.
I mean, how many different soliloquies from Uncle Charlie do you have to hear before you know that this guy is just a raging misogynist? He says things like, "Women are fools, they fall for anything." And then, of course, the great sit-down at the dinner where he says,
"The cities are full of women, middle-aged widows, husbands dead, husbands who've spent their lives making fortunes, working and working. And then they die and leave their money to their wives, their silly wives. And what do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands. Drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money. Proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, fat, greedy women."
"But they're alive, they're human beings."
"Are they?"
Now I'm going to read you something. This is by film scholar Michael Ryan. He says, Uncle Charlie, quote, uses his sex appeal for power and power alone, not even for money, which he acquires from his serial murders only to dismiss it. What he wants is to be superior to the human race and control everyone, especially women. He is absolutely isolated. He seduces only to conquer and destroy.
Right.
I really like that quote. I think it comments quite nicely on what I'm talking about here. All right, theme number four that rises to my surface anyway is subversion and perversity. And this is just kind of riffing on what we were talking about previously. Hitchcock, he subtly suggests a sexual conflict between the two Charlies, and she tells him,
"Because we're not just an uncle and a niece. It's something else. I know you. I know that you don't tell people a lot of things. I don't either. I have a feeling that inside you somewhere there's something nobody knows about."
"Something nobody knows?"
"Something secret and wonderful. And I'll find it out."
"It's not good to find out too much, Charlie."
"But we're sort of like twins, don't you see? We have to know."
You also recall how, as discussed, the uncle gives his niece this ring as a gift, places it on her finger in a manner slightly similar to either a proposal or something at the altar. And after she learns the truth about him, what happens? Well, she appears more as kind of a jilted lover betrayed by him than a disappointed niece. Some downright subversive stuff going on. Okay, as far as another theme, the film is very appropriately named Shadow of Doubt, because shadows and doubt, I think, are thematic key elements at play. Mm-hmm. We see shadows fall across the screen as foreshadowing elements. You think about the darkness that falls across the train when it pulls into the Santa Rosa Depot, and then the black billowing smoke that belches out. We see the high contrast lighting sometimes used in scenes with Uncle Charlie. And then, of course, there's visible doubt that creeps across young Charlie's face in several later scenes, too. Okay, one more message from the movie as a key takeaway. Suppression is the lesser of all evils. You've got young Charlie, she's kind of in a corner here. She's got a squelch her urge to kill or unmask her uncle. Why? To preserve the appearance of normality and to preserve the wholesomeness that Santa Rosa requires to maintain stability, purity, reputation, right?
Right.
Remember that Uncle Charlie's crimes, they go unpunished and unexposed, and he's actually given a hero's funeral at the end, which prevents the town from forever being stained. I'm going to read you another quote, and this is by Slant Magazine critic Fernando Croce. "Shadow of a Doubt," he said, "is about awakening, the simultaneous darkening and enlarging of the world. Young Charlie must muffle her knowledge as to not disturb the order of things. Hitch's habit of taking us to the edge of the abyss and then returning us with a wink, so often resulting in unconvincing happy endings, here seals one of his most pitiless visions of a monstrous cosmos admitted only to be denied." Very well articulated thought there. All right, sorry for all the soapboxing, but I thought there were some really key messages, morals, themes to examine in this movie.
Yeah.
A pretty streamlined plot, but a text that's loaded with subtexts. So it's an 80th birthday, Carrie, and it's customary to give presents on birthdays, right? Except it's the fans who continue to get the gifts. This is my main contention every month when I have the podcast. So let me ask you, what is Shadow of a Doubt's greatest gift to viewers?
I think the surprising heroine who has the toughness and the wisdom to outwit someone who's a very practiced at chicanery, and she notes it.
Mm-hmm.
And the very slow way that she moves from adoration and reverence to hate and wanting to destroy her beloved.
Completely.
Hitchcock played a little bit with that in the character of Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Who wanted to kill her husband, thought she was so much smarter than her husband. And she also ends up dead for whatever reason. But Daphne du Maurier keeps it very ambiguous about who killed Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
But here we know whose strength is responsible for the crushing of Uncle Charlie. So many Hitchcock movies take us from one major set piece to another major set piece. And this is just, as you said, small and pared down.
Right.
It has those classical tragic elements. It has all the unities. Mm-hmm. It seems to take place in one day, which it doesn't, but it's all in the same place, in the same city. And Teresa Wright just has so much soul as an actress. And she's quiet. And when she is, you know, as an innocent, her face just radiates, you know, goodness and love. But then, you know, she becomes so iron-fisted and iron-willed.
Mm-hmm, right.
That her transformation, that may be the gift, transformation of her character as from innocent to worldly.
We are on the same page. It's my greatest gift as well. This is a film that truly picks up steam as it progresses, does it not? I mean, it hits a higher gear by the midway point, which is when young Charlie discovers the unsavory facts about her uncle and we witness her sunny disposition depart. It's replaced by distrust and fear and hatred. Earlier, the niece had expressed disbelief and exhibited naivete about her uncle's seemingly shady side. But as the tale progresses, she demonstrates savvy intuition, healthy skepticism, cautious agency, and, yeah, bravery, standing up to Uncle Charlie. And it's all of these qualities that help her survive and keep the town's purity and incorruptibility intact. I completely agree. It's this transformation of young Charlie that serves as Shadow of a Doubt's greatest gift. Thematically, this is an exceptional loss of innocence and coming-of-age story in which a wide-eyed, gullible girl comes to realize that, yeah, the world isn't simply black and white. There are layers of gray that can cloud your judgment. She learns that, you know, some of the people populating the sophisticated world, including trusted loved ones, family, they may harbor evil secrets and terrible sins that can leave a harmful residue. Young Charlie is forced to grow up quickly and to shield her family from this danger, and she even has to stifle the truth at the very end when unsuspecting townspeople gather to mourn her uncle's death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fortunately, despite her pseudo-telepathic connection to Uncle Charlie, and as he says, the same blood runs through our veins, the niece ultimately won't be corrupted by his hate or his negativity, and she will have her family and a trusted partner in the detective to remind her that, yeah, the world is still full of good people. So the way Hitchcock and his collaborators slowly but consistently erode young Charlie's veneer of blind bliss and familial exuberance, thickening her skin for the harsher realities and the lethal dangers to come. It really makes for a captivating character study. The uncle, I think we can agree, he's the more fascinating figure in Shadow of a Doubt, but the niece's conversion from an innocent adolescent to an awakened young girl burdened by the unspeakable, in this case a shameful family secret she will probably need to take to her grave,
yeah,
it helps elevate this film to masterpiece status in my eyes.
It is. Yes.
Before we conclude, is there anything in the works that you'd like listeners to know about? Is there a book or an essay or an appearance or something on the horizon that listeners should keep on their radar?
Yes, I'm in the final laps of writing a biography of French filmmaker Agnès Varda.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know when it will be out, but my deadline is 2.5 months and I think I'm going to make it.
Get chopping, right?
Thank you very, very much, Eric, for this invitation.
Oh, it was wonderful. Wonderful getting to wax nostalgic with you about one of our favorite Hitchcocks, your favorite, The Remains, sounds like. And yeah, just to get the chance to talk to you. I've long admired your work, as I said. So thank you again for appearing on Cineversary and taking the deep dive with us into Shadow of a Doubt, Gary.
Thank you so much. And if you haven't seen it, what are you waiting for?
Absolutely. Stop the podcast right now and just get D to a Blu-ray. Okay, take care now, Kerry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Pretty grooving conversation there with Kerry Rickey, who I'm much obliged to for examining in depth why exactly Shadow of a Doubt is worth our adoration 8 decades after its release. Kerry, you're the podcast's new bestest friend, and thank you. That brings us to standing ovations. This is where I give a shout-out to a film, website, podcast, book, television program, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers just like you. This is a great time of year to share news about forthcoming movie anniversary events slated across 2023, is it not? And that means my shout-out for January is the calendar announced thus far for Fathom Events. So first, coming, hopefully, to a theater near you this month, it'll be a 70th anniversary showing of Roman Holiday, scheduled for January 22nd and January 25th. On February 2nd and 5th, you can celebrate the 30th anniversary of Groundhog Day in participating theaters. That's pretty cool. March will feature an encore 80th birthday honoring of Casablanca. Now, that was the subject of our Cineversary episode 2 months ago in November. Casablanca will be showing the 5th and 7th of March. April 16th and 20th bring The Big Lebowski back to the big screen for its 25th anniversary. And then Grease gets the grand 45th birthday treatment on May 14th and 17th, while Hairspray returns to theaters on June 11th and 14th to mark its 35th anniversary. National Lampoon's Vacation? Hey, I know there are fans out there. It turns the big 4-0 this year, and Fathom is celebrating by featuring it in key theaters July 16th and 19th. Moving on into the year, a month later, on August 13th and 16th, Bruce Lee makes a golden comeback a la Enter the Dragon, which turns 50 in 2023. Then, Rain Man fans get to honor its 35th anniversary on September 17th and 20th. What's in store for Halloween? Well, just in time, we'll see Hitchcock's The Birds take flight in select theaters on October 22nd and 23rd. Say Hello to My Little Friend all over again by heading to a nearby showing of Scarface on November 12th and 15th, as that picture also turns 40. And speaking of that number, we have A Christmas Story reaches that same numerical milestone this year, which is why you'll want to reserve a seat to a December 10th or 13th screening of the holiday classic. Yes, indeed, it's a great year for major movie anniversaries on our show, as well as at the cinema. So remember to mark a few of these dates in your calendar and partake in some nostalgic birthday cake for your eyes and ears. For full details, visit fathomevents.com. Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's cineverse group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donateCineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. So, looking ahead here, what's on tap for February? Next month, we will send an anniversary Valentine to perhaps the finest work in director John Huston's oeuvre, and an influential precursor to adventure films like the Indiana Jones movies. Join us next time as we celebrate the diamond anniversary, yep, the 75th birthday, of Treasure of the Sierra Madre, starring Humphrey Bogart and Walter Huston. And just a heads up, we will have two very special guests on that episode you will be delighted to hear from, so don't miss it. Until next time, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies. Because there's no doubt, right? They're not getting shadowier, they're getting better. As always, thanks for giving us a listen.